This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. The new book, Fast Food Nation, by Eric Schlosser, isn't just about how fast food has changed our diet. It's about how fast food has transformed our landscape, economy, workforce, and popular culture. Schlosser is a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. He's written extensive articles on such subjects as marijuana, the economics of the porn industry, and the prison industrial complex. Schlosser says the flavor industry has become crucial to fast food production. Fast food is so highly processed that much of the flavor is destroyed. It falls to the flavor industry to manufacture ways of putting the flavor back in through the sense of taste and smell. Schlosser visited the International Flavors and Fragrances Company, which adds aroma to French fries, as well as deodorant, dishwashing detergents, and furniture polish. He told Terry he was given blindfold tests with test tubes of fragrance.
Well, I really enjoyed my visit to IFF. It was like visiting Willy Wonka's factory. And the flavor industry came out of the perfume industry because they both deal with these very volatile essential oils and the sense of smell. And so the taste test that I had at IFF was a taste test without any food. They would dip, or I would dip, a slip of paper into a bottle containing this liquid and then smell the paper. And with your eyes closed, it was extraordinary how powerfully you could get a sense of those foods. The most incredible was grilled hamburger. And I dipped a small piece of paper into a bottle of liquid, closed my eyes and smelled, and you could have sworn there was someone grilling burgers in the room.
Now, is this because of them reducing the essence of hamburger into this test tube, or is this all chemically done?
Well, all aromas from foods are composed of a very, very complex mixture of chemicals. And by creating a recipe with the right chemicals, you can conjure up the smell of and the flavor of just about any food that you want. If you go into a grocery store and start looking at the packaged foods, or you look at the ingredients in fast food, there'll always be this phrase right around towards the end, natural flavor or artificial flavor. And those ingredients are a huge mix of chemicals that are put together to create the sense of that food.
What's the difference between natural and artificial flavor?
Well, the difference between natural and artificial flavor is that people prefer to see natural flavor on their foods, and it costs a little more. But ultimately, the distinction is a little bit arbitrary. I mean, natural flavors and artificial flavors are being manufactured at exactly the same specialty chemical plants. One chemist told me that the difference between a natural flavor and an artificial flavor is that the natural flavor is made with an obsolete technology. What's happened is that we have come to rely so much on processed food that is frozen or dehydrated or needs to be microwaved that the taste of our food now comes from these factories. And it's not necessarily dangerous or bad for you, or it's not necessarily something to be afraid about. It's just, I think, a very telling detail about what's happened to our food system in the last 30 to 40 years.
What I often wonder is, are these flavor enhancers intensified flavor? In other words, like if you're eating fast food, does it taste even more hamburgery or even more French fry-like than a home-cooked hamburger or French fry would taste? And if so, what impact does that have on your taste buds? Does unprocessed food start to seem meek and mild in comparison?
Well, the flavor industry has gotten to an incredibly sophisticated point in its development so that they can create flavors that are extremely subtle and lifelike, or they can make flavors that are exactly what you described, that are intense exaggerations. And they have flavors that they now invent for particular markets. They have flavors that are directed at particular age groups. For example, children's flavorings tend to be much stronger, and some of these fast food flavorings would be much stronger. But if you go to a health food store, it's remarkable how many health foods that are processed have natural flavors that are being made by the same companies, and they tend to be more subtle and sophisticated. This industry has developed, again, in the last 25 to 30 years, and it's got segments and market niches for every kind of consumer you can name.
Do most of the fast food, say hamburger and French fry, restaurants go for the intensified approach to flavor?
Well, fast food flavors tend to be less subtle than most other flavors. And in the book I write about French fries, McDonald's French fries are legendary for being the best tasting French fries in the fast food industry. And if you look at the list of ingredients in McDonald's French fries, there's a hint why. At the end, there's a phrase, natural flavor, and that flavor most likely is a beef flavor. McDonald's used to fry its fries in beef tallow and switched to vegetable oil in 1990, but they still wanted to maintain that very subtle taste of beef, and that's where it comes from the natural flavor. McDonald's will only acknowledge that that natural flavor comes from, quote, an animal product, unquote, but doesn't go beyond that. And the fries are delicious.
So the beef taste is the flavor enhancer stuff that's done at the chemical plant.
Absolutely. There is a flavor additive in McDonald's French fries that is manufactured and added during the processing phase that gives them that extra little oomph.
My guest is Eric Schlosser, and his new book is called Fast Food Nation. You visited a plant in Idaho that's one of the biggest French fry factories in the world. You say you saw 20 million pounds of French fries, most of them destined for McDonald's. Tell us a little bit about the process.
The French fry factory was extraordinary. From the outside, from parts of the inside also, it could have been an oil refinery. It was just a gigantic factory where potatoes enter in one end and out the other end are these sealed bags of perfect looking French fries that are frozen and ready to be reheated all over the United States. And there are electric eyes that spot imperfections in the French fries as they go down the conveyor belt, and compressed air blows the defective fries off of the belt, and miniature knives controlled by robots and machines cut off the imperfections and then return the fries to the conveyor belt. It's an extraordinary thing to see. And again, the fries that I had there were delicious, but it's a very far cry from how French fries used to be made, which was to peel the potatoes in the back of the restaurant, cut them up, and fry them.
There are people in lab coats monitoring the French fry process. What are they measuring?
They're measuring the sugar content of the fries. One of the key things about fast food is maintaining a uniformity and a consistency so that the food tastes everywhere exactly the same. And they want to make sure that each batch of fries is going to be exactly the same in size, shape, sugar content, so that they'll fry the same way. One of the main points of the book is exploring how these huge fast food companies have led to a similar centralization in how we produce our food that's completely changed how food is produced and processed and eaten in the United States.
Yeah, before we get to the processing and production of food, let's talk about the uniformity from franchise to franchise in the fast food chains. I mean, having this huge French fry plant is one way of ensuring that the French fries are uniform. What are some of the other standards that are set, for instance, at McDonald's?
Well, McDonald's has a huge, thick book, which is known as the Bible, which is how everything is to be done within the restaurant. Not only that, but the kitchens at McDonald's are highly dependent now on technology that requires as little skill as humanly possible to operate. And so working in a McDonald's kitchen is really a process of responding to various flashing lights and buzzers. And by creating this incredibly complex operating system reflected in the manual and all this technology at all these different kitchens, they can accomplish two things. They can make sure as much as humanly possible that the food tastes everywhere exactly the same, and they can reduce their dependence as much as possible on having to hire any skilled labor whatsoever. In the early days of McDonald's, they needed skilled short-order cooks. But by having everything in a book and by having everything dependent both on the food arriving there frozen and already processed and on these machines in the kitchen, they can rely on workers who don't have many skills and aren't going to gain many skills.
My guest is Eric Schlosser. He's the author of the new book, Fast Food Nation. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Schlosser. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and author of the new book, Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. Well, you write about how the meat industry is being transformed. You say chicken was first, and part of the reason why chicken was transformed was because of chicken nuggets. What did chicken nuggets do to the chicken industry?
The chicken McNugget had a revolutionary influence on the poultry industry. Chicken was already growing in popularity because of its health benefits as opposed to beef. But the chicken McNugget was the first mass-produced, manufactured poultry commodity. And whereas most people used to buy their chickens whole and cook them in an oven, the chicken McNugget really sped up the development of value-added foods in poultry, so that now the overwhelming majority of chicken is bought in pieces or as McNuggets. And it also helped bring to prominence a company called Tyson, which is now the biggest chicken company in the world, and which manufactures a huge proportion of the McNuggets for McDonald's, and also supplies poultry to 90 of the 100 top restaurant chains.
You say that fast food encouraged a system of production that turned many chicken farmers into little more than serfs. What do you mean by that?
Well, that wasn't only the fast food industry. It was really the rise of these big poultry companies. And as the industry concentrated, and the concentration both in the poultry industry and in the meat industry is in response to the concentration in the restaurant industry and the supermarket chains, because McDonald's doesn't want to deal with 100 suppliers. They want to deal with 3 or 4 or 5. So as their suppliers get bigger and bigger and more powerful, the farmers who raise chickens have fewer and fewer people to sell their chickens to. And you can really look by region after region. As these chicken companies have gotten more and more powerful, they have come up with contracts for the poultry growers that are really ultimately a little different from sharecropping contracts. For example, in almost all of these contracts, the big poultry company owns the birds from the moment that the eggs are dropped off until the moments that they're brought in and picked up at the farm for slaughter. But the grower has to do all the capital investment to raise these chickens. And the average income of these poultry growers is extremely low. In some cases, the average is about $15,000 a year. And what you see in the poultry industry is really the fear of a lot of cattlemen also, that the ranchers of America are going to soon become like the poultry growers and little more than sharecroppers.
Why are they concerned that the beef industry is going to take the turn that the poultry industry did?
Well, in the book I write about how their concern is that they're going to become like chicken farmers, simply because they saw how chicken farmers went from being independent farmers essentially to sharecroppers. Now their reason of concern is quite simple. Tyson is planning right now to purchase IBP, which is the largest beef meatpacking company in the United States. And many people think that Tyson may use the same methods with ranchers, or try to use the same methods that they have successfully used with poultry farmers.
You visited a slaughterhouse. How has the approach to killing cattle in a slaughterhouse changed recently?
At the same time that the fast food industry has grown exponentially in the United States, and I just want to give a quick sense of how fast and sudden this growth has been, really. In 1968, there were about 1,000 McDonald's. Now there are about 28,000 McDonald's, and there are 2,000 new ones every year. At the same time the fast food industry grew, the meatpacking industry was revolutionized. And again, in order to supply McDonald's, you needed big, big meatpacking companies that could provide a uniform product. And one of the things they did in these meatpacking plants was to almost bring a fast food mentality to how they treat their workers there. Meatpacking used to be one of the highest paid industrial jobs in the United States and remained so until the 1970s. Now it's one of the lowest paying industrial jobs in the United States, It's the most dangerous industrial job in the United States, and the pay is terrible, and the working conditions are terrible. And I saw that in the meatpacking plant that I visited in the High Plains.
What was most dangerous about working there?
The speed of the production line has been increased so much that it's almost unbelievable. In the 70s, when there was a strong union workforce, these production lines slaughtered about 175 cattle an hour. Now they slaughter anywhere from 350 to 400 cattle an hour, down one single production line. And cattle are being slaughtered and processed essentially like they were 100 years ago. There are some power tools, but basically the most important tool in a modern slaughterhouse is still a sharp knife being wielded by a human being. And when you have hundreds of people along a line with knives working at an incredibly fast pace, people get cut. They cut themselves. They cut people next to them. And the most common industry, the most common injury, I'm sorry, in a slaughterhouse today is a laceration, is a cut.
So you think that working conditions have gotten worse in the meat packing plants. Let's talk a little bit about working conditions for the people who give you the burgers and the fries, the people who actually work in the fast food restaurants. I think most people know that there are few full-time jobs for people who work at fast food operations. What are the wages like?
Well, the wages in the fast food industry are the lowest of any industry. And just to put things into perspective, I mean, the working conditions in America's meatpacking plants are the worst that I've ever seen. And I did a long piece on migrant labor in California. It's nowhere near as bad in America's fast food restaurants, but the pay is the lowest. The fast food industry is the largest minimum wage paying industry in the United States. The industry made a deliberate decision that instead of having a small, well-trained, relatively well-paid workforce, they would instead have a large, poorly trained, poorly paid workforce. And as a result, there's huge turnover in the fast food industry, anywhere from 300 to 400% a year, which means the typical fast food worker quits or is fired every 3 to 4 months. Because so much of the knowledge and the skill is built into the operating system, is built into the technology that they have in these kitchens, it's really a job that involves following orders and doing things according to the book with very little initiative, and it's deliberately kept that way.
Well, you could argue that this type of job has its place, particularly for teenagers who don't necessarily plan to keep a job for a long time. They can get a job, make a few dollars, and leave.
There's no question there are some very good things about these fast food jobs. Some of the poorest, most disadvantaged people in America get their first jobs at fast food restaurants, as do many teenagers. But there's no reason why these jobs need to be structured this way. There's one fast food chain that stands apart from the rest, which is In-N-Out Burger in California. It's a large regional chain, and starting workers at In-N-Out earn $8 an hour. The typical manager at In-N-Out earns $80,000 a year. They provide medical coverage, dental coverage to full-time workers. They have very low menu prices, and they're very successful. So the fast food industry has pursued a certain model of labor organization, which is anti-union, which is really keeping workers as unskilled as possible. But it was by no means inevitable they'd do so, and it's not the only way. If you look at the rise of the fast food industry, it's directly linked to the decline in the minimum wage in the United States. The minimum wage peaked around 1968 and declined 40% for the next 20, 25 years. That's when the fast food industry grew exponentially. And if you look in Congress...
You mean decline according to the cost of living?
Declined in real terms. The minimum wage fell by 40% after 1968. And those are the years that the fast food industry grew exponentially. And if you look in Congress, the fast food and the restaurant industry are the biggest opponents of any rise in the minimum wage. And that's because they've set up their restaurant kitchens so that they're dependent on large numbers of unskilled, poorly paid workers.
Have the fast food operations worked to keep out unions?
McDonald's in particular has been expert at keeping out unions. again, part of their labor structure and labor organization is ideal for keeping out unions. If you have 300 to 400% turnover, people quitting every 3 to 4 months, if you have large numbers of unskilled workers or teenagers or recent immigrants, these are the most difficult people for labor unions to organize traditionally. So part of the turnover and part of their recruitment of recent immigrants and teenagers is intentionally or maybe unintentionally part of their anti-union efforts.
Eric Schlosser is the author of Fast Food Nation. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Eric Schlosser, author of the new book Fast Food Nation, about how fast food has changed our diet, the landscape, economy, workforce, popular culture, and the meatpacking industry.
One of the chapters in your book has the subtitle, An Ideal System for Pathogens. Do you think that fast food is connected to the rise in foodborne illnesses?
Well, there's no question that the concentration and the restructuring of the meatpacking industry in particular is a perfect vehicle for the widespread transmission of all kinds of pathogens. And you really see that with E. coli 0157H7, which is the hamburger bacteria that is especially lethal for small children and the elderly.
Oh, tell us more about that. Why? What accounts for it?
Well, if you went back in time 25 to 30 years ago, ground beef was typically produced by small processors, or it was made in the back of a grocery store from old scraps or leftover scraps of meat. So when you got a package of ground beef, there may be portions of one or two different cattle, maybe only one cattle in that package. The typical fast food hamburger today has pieces of dozens, if not hundreds, of individual cattle in it. And that's because the ground beef is being made at gigantic processing plants, often near these same slaughterhouses in the high plains. One of these plants can produce 800,000 pounds of ground beef a day. And it's just a gigantic admixture of thousands of cattle. If one of those cattle is sick, it can contaminate an enormous amount of that ground beef. One estimate is that one diseased cattle can contaminate 32,000 pounds of ground beef. And that ground beef isn't being sold locally like it was 25 to 30 years ago. That ground beef may be shipped throughout the entire United States and often overseas. So one sick steer can create havoc and make people sick throughout the United States and in foreign countries.
And is that directly related to fast food or just to, like, all the changes in meat processing?
All the changes in meat processing, but you have to keep in mind that the McDonald's Corporation is the largest purchaser of beef and pork in the United States and the second largest purchaser of chicken. So an enormous amount of the changes that we've seen in meatpacking has been to fit the needs of McDonald's, of Burger King, and the other fast food chains.
Are there any special safety precautions that the fast food chains take in preparing meat and chicken to make sure that that infection isn't spread from the food?
The fast food chains, after the Jack in the Box outbreak, have really worked hard to prevent contamination in the meat and everything else they sell. The fast food contracts with the meatpacking companies are extremely stringent in terms of the testing of the meat and what level of bacteria count is allowed in the meat, and they require stringent testing for E. coli 0157, and Jack in the Box really took the lead in insisting on that. So the meat that's being sold to McDonald's and Jack in the Box is the most tested meat in the United States. The unfortunate thing about that is some of the dirtiest meat and some of the least tested meat is being sold to American supermarkets and being served to American school children in the schools. The fast food companies have demanded much more stringent bacterial testing than the U.S. government has for the American people.
Did you find that paradoxical?
Well, one of the ironies is that the fast food companies have played a central role in creating the conditions for these pathogens to spread, but right now are avoiding the worst consequences because they have the buying power to insist on the cleanest meat. So a rational government or a rational system of government would demand for ordinary consumers the same level of testing and hygiene that the fast food companies are now getting from their suppliers.
Now, you mentioned that McDonald's is the company that buys the most beef and pork in the United States. What do they do with the pork?
Well, they are now adding bacon to their burgers.
Oh, sure.
And they serve it with their breakfast meals. And, you know, McDonald's purchasing decisions have an incredible, incredible effect on commodity markets. This past summer, anticipating protests against biotech foods, McDonald's basically told its suppliers it would no longer purchase any genetically engineered potatoes. And as a result, the market for genetically engineered potatoes in the United States just about vanished. McDonald's control and power over these markets, on the one hand, has a lot of harmful effects. On the other hand, I think it has a great deal of potential for changing the way that things are and changing a lot of the abuses. If McDonald's were to say tomorrow that it would no longer purchase beef from meatpacking plants where workers were being mistreated, I can guarantee you that the working conditions in those meatpacking plants would change immediately.
McDonald's not only buys more beef and pork than any other company in the United States, it operates more playgrounds than any other private entity. I think we've all seen the playgrounds attached to McDonald's restaurants. Why are they emphasizing playgrounds?
Well, McDonald's made the decision very early on that it would be a place for families and that it would address a great deal of its marketing to children. And adding playgrounds to its restaurants was just part of that strategy. And again, there is an insidious side of it, of targeting children, but there's also the side that in a lot of communities where local governments are unwilling to build playgrounds, McDonald's is a place where people can bring their children to play. Now, there are costs for that because McDonald's is marketing to children food that is extremely unhealthy for children.
And what's unhealthy about it for children?
Well, if you look at the Happy Meals and the children's meals being sold by the fast food companies, they're extremely high in saturated fats and salts and sugars. And children develop their tastes for food that then become lifelong tastes in these early years. And the fast food companies have encouraged eating habits that have led to an enormous rise in obesity, not only among children, but also among adults in the United States. If you look at the rise in obesity in the United States on a graph, it neatly parallels the growth of the fast food industry. Now, fast food isn't the only cause. A lack of exercise and spending too much time in front of the TV are contributing factors. But worldwide, wherever the fast food restaurants have gone, obesity has increased at roughly the same rate.
We'll continue with Terry's interview with Eric Schlosser after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is Eric Schlosser. His new book is called Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. So one other facet of the fast food industry I want to ask you about, and that is that fast food restaurants have become big targets for robbers. And you say that the fast food chains are even bigger targets than gas stations and convenience stores. Why is that?
Well, it's very hard to get the exact numbers on restaurant robberies because the restaurant industry has fought and fought against having anyone compile them nationwide. But the convenience stores and gas stations that used to be such an easy target, as well as the banks, have taken all kinds of steps in the last 15 to 20 years to prevent being robbed, which leaves fast food places, which increasingly are open late at night, are staffed by young employees, and have an incredible amount of cash on hand. So fast food restaurants are now much more attractive targets than convenience stores. At 7-Eleven, the average robbery now gets about $37 because of how they manage their cash at 7-Eleven. If you hit a fast food restaurant in the right way at the right time, you can get thousands and thousands of dollars. And young employees, and I found this again and again when I spent time with high school kids who were working at these restaurants, they had no idea that these were such dangerous jobs. In the very early morning hours when the restaurant's opening, or in the late evening hours, right before closing time. One of the most chilling statistics is that about two-thirds of all fast food robberies are committed with the help of current or former employees. So these are inside jobs, and I think that statistic shows you the degree of loyalty that these employees have to their businesses. There's enormous turnover, and there's a feeling that their employer doesn't care about them, so these places are fair game to rob.
Well, I imagine some people might take a job in the first place with the intention of later robbing the store, but the whole point of the job is to scope it out inside.
That's absolutely true. But if you look at the people who the fast food chains tend to employ and the demographic for robbery, there's a very close correlation between economic background and age, et cetera, et cetera. Short of robbery, though, studies have found that more than half of fast food employees who don't commit a robbery steal from their employers. And that doesn't include eating food that they're not supposed to eat. So I think that on both sides of the labor equation, there's not a great deal of loyalty at the moment in the fast food industry.
I think your book in some ways reads like a lot of trade-offs. You know, fast food is comparatively inexpensive. It's, you know, about the cheapest food you can eat. But there are trade-offs that come with that. The employees aren't well paid. There's a lot of ripple effects in the rest of the economy and the food industry that haven't necessarily been good. Did you find this to be a series of trade-offs yourself?
Well, I tried to write something that wasn't black and white and that didn't demonize people and that tried to show the complexity of what's happened. And in the fast food industry, I don't think most of the people are bad people. I think they're business people. There are enormous trade-offs. And what I really tried to show was the real cost of this food, because it is inexpensive food and it is convenient. And most of it tastes pretty good. It's designed to taste good. But I try to show all the other consequences that you don't think about and that aren't reflected in the menu price of fast food.
Consequences like the ones we've been talking about. Any other consequences you want to mention that you haven't referred to?
Well, the main consequences are the influence of the fast food industry on the service sector economy and how work is structured. They really changed the American diet. A hamburger, French fries is really a post-war American meal. And as we were just talking about obesity, I mean, the cost of obesity is 300,000 people a year dying in the United States and $250 billion in health costs. One thing maybe we haven't talked about as much is literally the influence of fast food on the landscape and on the community. The fast food industry, and particularly McDonald's, created a business model that's been imitated all across the retail economy. The whole idea of creating a specific retail environment and then reproducing it again and again and again, thousands of times in different places, really started with McDonald's and the fast food industry. And now, you know, the founders of the Gap were quite open about how they were inspired by McDonald's and KFC, but also Sunglass Hut and Banana Republic and all these other chain stores that have made the outskirts of one American community almost indistinguishable from the outskirts of another American community, really started out with the fast food industry. And it's spread across the world so that you can be very, very far away from the United States and have the odd feeling that you've never left home.
What are a couple of the most absurd moments that you witnessed while covering the fast food industry?
It's hard to pick. There were so many. I think that being at the Flavor Factory was an extraordinary experience, and that was a fascinating day. I went to a fast food convention at the Mirage in Las Vegas, where Mikhail Gorbachev was the keynote speaker. And that was a really surreal experience, because here was the former head of the great enemy of America really speaking in the temple of the new America and praising fast food and seeking investment from fast food executives. And it reminded me of the days in ancient Rome when, in ancient Rome, whenever they conquered another country, they would bring the conquered leader of that country and put him on display in the circus. And seeing Mikhail Gorbachev before these fast food executives had somewhat the same feel to me.
If you were king of the world, is there anything you would want to do to reform the industry?
If I were king of the world, I would really try to internalize the costs that they're imposing left and right on the rest of society. And the business has so been driven solely by the profit motive without any regard for some of the consequences. And I think many of these consequences were unintended, unintentional, that I'm not blaming them personally. But there's a very big difference between having 1,000 McDonald's and having 28,000 McDonald's. The first thing that I would do, the most important thing that I would do, would be prevent them from marketing food to children that is extremely unhealthy for children. And in Western Europe, you're finding countries are banning the advertising of unhealthy food to children. It's one thing if a grown-up wants to walk in and get a triple cheeseburger with bacon and a large order of fries, but Happy Meals that are advertised so aggressively to children shouldn't be so unhealthy. The other thing I would do if I could wave a magic wand and change the industry, this summer McDonald's issued new rules for its suppliers about how poultry and livestock should be treated. And this was in response to protests by animal rights organizations. And so McDonald's has issued edicts saying that animals must be treated humanely by its suppliers. And I would really like to see McDonald's take the same interest in the human beings who are being employed by these suppliers. McDonald's, again, could change the working conditions in these meatpacking plants almost overnight if it demanded these changes. And meatpacking is the most dangerous job in the United States today.
Well, Eric Schlosser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Eric Schlosser is a correspondent for Atlantic Monthly and the author of Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. This is Fresh Air.